Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast with me, your host, Jeffrey Hart, aka Jeffrey the Natural Builder. Every fortnight, join me as I talk to designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things.
Hello and welcome to episode 80. This episode is part of two episodes where we're talking to architect Claire Nash. Both this episode and episode 81 were recorded in the same session and focus on the two books that Claire has written. This first episode is about her book, An Architect's Guide to Achieving a Work-Life Balance. And episode 81 is focused around her book, Contemporary Vernacular Design, How British Housing Can Rediscover Its Soul. Quickly, before this episode, I just want to take a quick moment to say a huge thank you to Elizabeth Roman and Shannon Berry, both of who have signed up as Building Sustainability Superheroes on our Patreon site. They've both pledged at the £5 level, which means I will be sending them a hand-carved wooden spoon, hand-carved by me. This little batch at the moment is I'm carving some birch, which actually came from a tree that was just behind my house. One of its kind of larger limbs had to be taken down. So yeah, it's a very, very connected to my house and the place I am. So hopefully that's a nice thing to receive. I also want to say a big thank you to Eleanor, who has upgraded to the same £5 level. So thank you to all three wonderful people. You really do help this podcast exist. Okay, I haven't got too much to say. My brain is somewhat mushy at the moment. I do just want to say that there is a slightly clunky swap when we start talking a little bit too far down the road of talking about the Contemporary Vernacular Design book. And there's a little swerve as we pull it back into this book. If you're disappointed by that, then just listen to episode 81. All right, that's it. I'm back at the end. Enjoy Claire Nash.
Okay, so I'm Claire Nash and I run Claire Nash Architecture, which is an eco-architecture firm. There's nine of us now. I've also written a couple of books. Contemporary Vernacular Design, How British Housing Can Rediscover Its Soul is one. And the other one is Design Your Life, An Architect's Guide to Work-Life Balance.
And where are you based?
Oxfordshire. I mean, I myself are based on the edge of border of Northamptonshire, Oxfordshire, but I have a team all over Oxfordshire.
Did I read that you're an all-female practice?
We're not all female. I think the first edition of the book says that, but that was quickly changed to...
right,
that was a misprint. We're majority female, but by far, yeah. There's two blokes and seven women.
Okay.
And at one point we were all female, It wasn't totally wrong. It's just it's changed.
Right. Okay. And was that in any way sort of by design?
Not particularly. It just...
Just how it happened.
Yeah. I suppose the way the practice operates, which is very flexible and remote working, and there's lots of support. And I suppose because I'm a female leader, that attracted other women. I would have men apply, but majority women. Mm-hmm. So it ended up being the ones I chose were majority women also. And that worked. It is a nice atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's a really nice place to work.
Well, I went down a little bit of a research rabbit hole and was looking at the gender balance in architecture, and was surprised to see that overall it's something like 70-30 male to female. But then under 30, it was almost an exact 50-50 split.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been like that for a while. And what tends to happen is women drop off later on.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So when they have children or before then, even. So they might do their degree and then change their mind during work experience, or they'll get past that bit and then change their mind in the second lot of work experience or for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Well, I know quite a few reasons. Long hours culture is one. Definitely for parents, it's tricky. I mean, post-COVID, we're more open to flexible working. But before that, there was definitely a real culture of you have to be in the office, you have to always be available for collaboration or the next big idea. It just wasn't seen as viable to be running a remote working practice like I do. Yeah, so there was lots of that. And it was competitive, and sometimes that just gets you down after a while. I don't think it's changed that much. I still think it's the same, even with having had the younger 50-50 for a long time now. Mm. I think it is getting better, but only very slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I guess these things happen incrementally, don't they? Not all of a sudden.
Yeah. And I also think it's, you know, new generations coming in with new ideas. The younger people are expecting to change jobs more frequently, and they're more demanding of work-life balance. And, you know, when people are retiring who had the opposite view about how working life should be. So that's all changing too.
And do you think, well, I mean, what we're going to talk about a lot is work-life balance. Do you have it? Have you managed the mythical work-life balance?
I think I do. I wouldn't have said that for every week of my the past few years. It definitely comes and goes, but the majority I would say would be yes. I have, and there are peak periods. I mean, sometimes you just have to, you know, like I've recently taken on quite three people, and that's taken quite a lot of effort, the onboarding and keeping things going project wise so that there isn't, you know, a drop in activity, that kind of thing. That takes a bit out of you. So for the about 1 or 2 months, I've felt like, oh, this is actually quite a stressful period. But now I'm out of that and things are way better and work-life balance is really good. So I think, yeah. And it's like if you're really clear on your purpose and why you're doing something, then it doesn't actually matter that much if you have short periods of stress and overwhelm and so on, because you know it will pass and you know the end result is really worth getting to. So I don't have any bother with that. But if it was all the time and I couldn't see the end of it and that it wasn't aligned with my purpose, then I'd have, yeah, it wouldn't be the same.
I think it's one of those things. I've done stressful jobs and you sort of don't realise it's stressful, and then it's just building and building and building, and suddenly it's your entire life. And then there's usually some sort of breaking point, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah. For me, that was illness.
Right.
And it wasn't even a serious illness. It was just fatigue, really. Mm-hmm. But it worried me because I thought it could become chronic fatigue if I let it continue. And I've always been a high energy person, and that disappeared totally. And also I wasn't able to deliver the work quality that I wanted to. And it just came about from, I did really well on blogging and lots of work came in, and then I stupidly took all of it because I had started in a recession and was like, oh, this might not happen again. And then just couldn't do it all. So I was forced into taking on my first member of staff, which I was worried about because I thought I'm not necessarily going to be good at managing people. But actually that worked really well that with that first, she was a student because I used to teach at Oxford Brookes. Well, I still do occasionally. And I thought, well, this is a test. She was planning to go and work in Australia 6 months later. So I thought, well, I'll try it out. And if it doesn't work, it's only 6 months. But it worked. And so when she left, I replaced her with two new people, and that worked. And it was very much learning by doing. But yes, so I learned the hard way about work-life balance and how important it is. But essentially, somebody termed it as once, if you run your own business, you are the golden goose. And if you're not well, then it can't produce any golden eggs.
Yeah. Yeah. Lovely golden building eggs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So I'm kind of interested in that. What was the sort of story leading up to that? So I think I read somewhere that you were in larger practices. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I worked in a few different practices before, and one abroad as well. And the longest one I stayed at was a multi, it did a wide range of works like schools, universities, prisons, footballers' wives, sort of flats, and heritage stuff as well. It was really good for experience building, and had quite a good work-life balance as well. They were quite good about not long hours culture, and usually it was 50-50 split, male-female too. Mm-hmm. Whereas previous offices I'd worked in, it had just been me and the receptionist who was female. So that was nice. And to be honest, until I got there, I didn't really know, I didn't realise I was missing that, because I was quite happy in my mostly male-dominated environment. And then I went there and I thought, oh, this is nice, actually. And it made me think about, it's just nice to have a mixture. It's a nice atmosphere. Yeah, so that was that. And then I'd done a research proposal at the end of my part two architecture qualification, where if I wrote a dissertation in 3 years after that, I could get, it would qualify as a master's. And I was really excited about it, and it would involve traveling abroad, but I couldn't really see how I was going to manage that when I had a job. And then the recession happened, and the practice I worked for wasn't really hit by the credit crunch because we didn't do that many houses. But when Cameron cut public spending, that hit all our public funded projects. So they did three rounds of redundancies, and then they said, we'd like to avoid a fourth round. So if anybody wants to take 6 months off, then this would be a good time to do it, so we don't have to make a fourth round. So I thought, well, I've got my research that I really want to do, and here's a good opportunity to do it. And I knew I was taking the risk, but I just thought, now or never. So I did that, and I went abroad, and I worked on organic farms and did couch surfing to kind of pay, help with funding my way around. And some of that was really useful because people I stayed with, like I found I did learn Spanish, but I found the Chilean dialect really hard because they speak so fast as well. And I stayed with, on the working on organic farms thing, there was a couple of architects were doing that. So they came and helped me translate, but also because they were interested themselves. So it was kind of, a fun thing to do. So that was really beneficial. There were lots of little things that happened along the way, like couch surfing in China. There was a lady there who helped me translate in interviews with a professor, and she helped me find some English students to help me with some more translating. And yeah, it was just a really nice experience of people helping each other and learning languages, and also just finding out that people all over the world have exactly the same problems. They all worry about their bills. They all mutter and groan about their neighbours.
The universals.
Yeah, and that was really reassuring. And of course, big cultural differences as well, and seeing how those tied into architecture and how it expressed itself through people's homes. But what I was mainly exploring was how vernacular technologies are inherently sustainable and how we could use those in modern sustainable building for homes.
And this was what became your first book?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a research paper, and then I thought, oh, it's just going to sit on the shelf of the library and only other master's students will read it. And it seemed a bit of a shame. And I thought I could widen it as well, because I only had, I think, 3 or 4 UK case studies. And then the rest were very international, you know, Papua New Guinea, China, South America and so on. And I thought there's a lot in Europe I could look at, as well as more UK ones. And then it would be more useful for practitioners in the UK and house builders and developers and so on. So, yeah, I approached the RIBA publishing arm about that, and they said yes, which really surprised me, because so yeah, then I had to go and do it all the extra case studies and so on. But it was again, it was really fun, although also very daunting. I mean, knocking on somebody's door on a Friday evening when you know they just want a glass of wine, really, and not to talk to somebody on the doorstep, and the first instinct is, oh, what are you selling me? So I had to always start with, hello, I'm an architect, like really fast.
I'm not here to bother you. Well, I am a little, but...
yeah, but that was the only way to get the direct feedback about how well the architect's intentions or the housing association's intentions had worked for the actual user, the people in the homes themselves.
And then did you go back to your... the practice where you'd taken 6 months off, or was that?
Yeah, so when I came back, they had given my projects to other people, which is fair enough. And so I was easy to lose then, and things weren't any better in 2011. The recession was still going full pelt, and so yeah, I lost my job, but in a very friendly way, and I still kept in contact with everybody, and some of them tried to get me job interviews, which was very nice. So I felt well supported and not actually that scared, which is a bit weird. But yeah, but it did take me, because it was the recession and, you know, colleagues of mine were sending out 100 CVs and getting 0 interviews. So I was even lucky to get job interviews, and I got 2. And both times it was me and somebody else, and they went for the other person in the end. And I thought, well, maybe something is trying to tell me something. And maybe I should go freelance. And then I just happened to bump into somebody who'd offered me freelance work in the past on a train. And I didn't want it then, because I was happy where I was, but I did want it now.
Yeah.
And it was a good offer anyway. It just wasn't the right time before. So I worked with him for a bit and another architect as well, on a freelance basis. But I found, although the work was good and working with them was great, I found it quite isolating. And also hard to manage workload, because it would be like all or nothing. And there wasn't so much, it wasn't very predictable. And I thought, this isn't very sustainable long term. So I got a job as a dinner lady, more or less. I'd load up the van with the food from the tea room and then take it to the school and deal it out and things. And that was really nice, because I was working with other people in the middle of the day. And then either side, I could focus on my business, which just started. I mean, weirdly, the hurdle for me was paying for the insurance, because I know you have to keep it going 6 years after the project's finished. And I was worried, like, what if this doesn't work and I'm still paying for that insurance? But in the end, I just thought, no, I've got to give it a go. So I put postcards in local shops, and then work did start trickling in, and then I could do less and less dinner ladying.
Yeah.
And I sort of replaced that isolation with going to networking events where there would be a business speaker. So I'd get to learn stuff and also meet other business owners and things and share tips and stuff, and read loads of books about how to run a business at the same time. And that network, although that particular group has stopped, it's still really valuable to me.
Yeah.
And I've got other networks as well. So I just think it's so important to reach out to other people at those, because it's such a lonely experience being a business owner. And there's so much you can learn from other people. But yeah, I'd really recommend that if anybody else is thinking about doing that.
In your architecture training, is there any part of that which is teaching you how to run a business?
Yeah, a small bit. You do a module per year, but not in the first year. Yeah, and I found it quite abstract, because until you apply it to your own business, it doesn't really make sense.
Hmm.
And a lot of the systems that they sort of advocated didn't really work for me anyway, when I actually got round to it. That I found the knowledge and things from business books were better, and from other business owners too, or people giving talks, that kind of thing. Because they were more sort of, I suppose, they're kind of, they're more specialist because it's about business. It isn't about architects trying to run business. It's just business. So I found that more useful. Yeah, and certain key books really changed everything, like The E-Myth, which is all about systems being the key to both profit and longevity of the business and allowing you more creative time and all that stuff. But made a really big impression on me quite early. And it meant that I did develop systems from quite an early point. So when I took on my first member of staff, every question she asked me, I turned into an Evernote, which is what I was using at the time, with sort of screenshots of how to do things and answers. And then I had a library of stuff. So when the next two came, they just could use that and the questions were less. And so each time I was building up all these systems. And then, of course, my team developed their own systems, which are better than mine anyway. So it's just this constant sort of layering of more efficient operations that save you time and mean you can make more money and have more creative time mm-hmm. and more time off.
Yeah, the dream.
Yeah.
What does your life look like in terms of your work-life balance? Like, what does having a good work-life balance mean in your world?
So I only work sort of 25, 30 hour week. And so I'll always fit in some form of exercise every day. It doesn't have to be particularly intense, sometimes just a walk. But I find swimming is really good for my creative brain. Like I work really, write better blogs after I swim and things like that. So I tend to see, rather than seeing it as time off, I see it as an investment because my brain works better afterwards.
That's a good way of retraining your brain, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It makes a big difference. So I call them creativity breaks rather than a walk
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah.
Because it's true. Sitting at the number of times before I started thinking about it like that, I'd be sat at the computer going, oh, no, I've got to get this out, I've got to get this out. And then I'd force myself to stop and go for a walk. And then I'd come back and realise I didn't have to do any of that anyway. There was a much quicker solution. And I saved myself buckets of time. And, so the opposite effect of what you'd think.
Mm-hmm.
But also more family time. So I have a son, he's 4, and I really like seeing him in the morning and at tea time and not having to come home. I mean, not feeling like I'm stuck in traffic on the commute when I want to be with him or that sort of thing. And definitely when he was very tiny, I was able to run my business around looking after him. So that made life a lot easier.
Is that because of the remote working?
Yeah, it makes a huge difference because I could just be sat there breastfeeding, which you can't do in an office. And, you know, I could be sketching at the same time. I could take him for walks when he'd fall asleep and I'd have client phone calls and things. You can't do that when you're in an office or if you have to have a commute. So I think it only really works that kind of thing if you can work from home some of the week at least.
Is there I'm sort of skipping back a bit, but is there the impression I get is there's a culture of working too much or too long hours in the sort of architecture world. And I certainly know from friends who are architects that's sort of instilled from the very beginning of the training.
Yeah. On my before I even started the course properly, I did interior architecture as a degree and then I switched to architecture later. But I said, I quite like on a Wednesday afternoon, like the rest of the university shuts down for sport and I quite like to join in with something. I'm not sure what yet, maybe water polo, but and he said, previous students have found that really hard. Like they might have done it for a bit and then they've had to give up because architecture is all encompassing and people find it really hard to fit in anything else. And I thought, crumbs, that sounds awful. I couldn't necessarily fit in that Wednesday afternoon because that clashed with other things. But I did consistently do sport all the way through.
Mm.
And I found it helped me, the opposite of what that course director had said. So I think sometimes it's a mindset thing. It's not, it doesn't have to be true just because somebody says that. I found it made me more efficient and definitely more healthy and gave me more energy and more ideas and all of which benefited the what I produced, and I got really good grades at the end. So, win-win.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's still, I think university, because of the mental health issues, universities are doing a lot now. Brooks, where I work, stopped their 24-hour card for students because it's supposed to show that we don't want you coming in at 3 a.m.
As in like an access card?
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know how long that continued or whether it worked, but that was an intention to help reduce this idea. So I do think it's changing, definitely, and universities are really, they're not saying what that course director said to me anymore. Mm-hmm. They're saying the opposite. Like, I hear it all the time. Go for a walk, for goodness sake. Get away from your screen. And, and some of the students I used to teach, they were so super talented and would almost have nervous breakdowns. One of them I was really worried about. And it just gets into a very negative cycle where you end up working later and later and then seeing people less and less and having even less sleep. And so you're socially isolating yourself as well as being deeply unhealthy, food and sleep and all the rest, no exercise. And it's just so bad for you. It's so important, that interaction with other students. Remember when I used to share a house, we used to all, watch rubbish telly together and share meals, and that stuff is so important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was worrying, but he came out of it, and other students have come out of it. But it's worrying. It had to get to that point.
Yes. This all sounds very familiar to me. I especially, I've been self-employed for a long time, and it was only when I started working I worked in a workshop for a year, making furniture, and I was blown away, the idea that you could, if you weren't finished just before 5 o'clock, you just put your tools away and went home, and then you did the work in the morning. That was just a shocker to me, that I didn't have to just slave away all the time. When I saw your book, I just really wanted to talk to you, because on just a personal level, I find the work-life balance thing so difficult. And I think it was definitely instilled in that sort of university time.
Yeah. Yeah, there's still, I don't know, maybe it's also my time in when I lived in Germany, and they're a bit French in there. I mean, they don't have their big long lunches like the French do, but they're much more like, this is when I work and this is my playtime. And they have much more focus on the separation. And, or they did then, it might have changed now. This was 2004. And they have more bank holidays. And it was a real culture of just being focused on work when you're there, and then you can have all your playtime. And people would just literally leave at 5 o'clock all the time. There wasn't the long hours culture that you have in Britain, even within architecture. So that was also a wake up call, because, nobody thinks of the Germans having poor output.
No, the opposite.
Yeah. So I just thought, there's something missing in Britain. Yeah. On that front. Because it's not just the architecture world, it's other ones too. I think some of it comes a bit from less than great business models where you're relying on free overtime to make that fee work. And, the race to the bottom of the fees is really a big problem in architecture. And I've managed to get around that by demonstrating value more clearly to clients. Instead of assuming that they're going to understand what an architect does, I assume that they haven't got a clue. And it's taken me years to get to this point. And it's a constant tweaking, because you don't always want to stay in the same place. You're sometimes trying to attract a different market. Yeah, but the aim is to show that you get what they need, and then how you're going to offer it to them, and make it super clear. And also niching, because the more you niche, the more work you get, and the more people realise they're in the right place and this is who they want to work with.
Yeah.
And also, from our perspective on the inside, we get better and better at doing that thing, and really enjoy being better at doing that thing. It's a really nice feeling. And that means we, you know, with our business model, we can charge more because we are better at doing that thing. And the client understands that. And yeah, and then we don't need to, you know, nobody works unpaid overtime.
Is there a concern about being pigeonholed?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that can happen. Like within practice, it happened to a colleague of mine. He was really good at feasibility studies and ended up just doing that. And even though he was older than me, had very little site experience, whereas I was much younger and running three jobs on site simultaneously. So we swapped. And if you have an open-minded sort of practice, they'll let you do that because it's all about growth, personal growth, and they want to retain good quality staff and that kind of thing. So within practice, there is that worry, but also I get that from business owners as well. They want to demonstrate that they can do everything, and they don't want to nail themselves down to one thing because they're worried about something really exciting going in a different direction. But actually, if you're the potential client, and I mean, we do this when we go onto Google ourselves, we're looking for a very specific thing. And if we go onto a website that offers maybe that, but also six other things, we're like, are we quite in the right place? I'm not sure. But if we arrive on the website that has the thing that we want and it makes sense, and it's saying what we want and how we want to get there and that kind of thing, then they know they're in the right place. And that's 90% of your marketing or, you know, your sales conversion done already. Yeah. Then all you have to, you know, they're already fairly convinced and all you have to do is turn up and represent that, which is easy if you've written it yourself anyway and you've employed people who share those values and want to do that same stuff.
So this sort of comes from a personal place. I've got two older brothers, and both of them from very early teenage years knew exactly what they wanted to do and they went and did it. And then I came along and thought, well, I like making things, and didn't have any more sort of idea than that. And so for me to find my niche has involved a lot of kind of bouncing around and trying things and, you know, realizing what doesn't work to actually find what does work. Have you got any sort of tips on how to sort of zone in on your niche in a bit more sort of structured way, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, I did a fair bit of meandering as well. You know, I worked on all those different projects at that previous practice and really enjoyed it. And it is hard to find that thing. But I think I still use this now because I'm going off in slightly different directions now. But it's the thing that makes you really excited. If there's something, even if you don't yet quite know what it's going to become, just keep nurturing it and exploring it and writing about it. Or, you know, some people don't like writing, so whatever it is that you do to explore that further, then you'll find it. And a lot of the things I've done have been just about, oh God, I'm so excited about that. And I just keep going to events about that and reading about that. And then eventually I go, oh, right, this is the thing. And because something else comes up and it connects and then it makes sense. But I mean, I arrived at barn conversion just because I'm a farmer's daughter. I love being outside in fields. I understand old farm buildings and how they should be. And it really tied in with my research that I'd done about rural vernacular and how buildings fit in the countryside. And there's a useful diagram as well called ikigai, which is a Japanese word, which I've forgotten what it means. But you basically have three circles, and it's like what you love, what people will pay you for, and what you're good at, and the thing in the middle is the gold.
Right. Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's quite helpful to sort of streamline your thinking if you're struggling a bit. And sometimes it's like smack in your face. Like I've gone into garden design more recently. That came up in the ikigai, but I ignored it.
Right.
Because I wasn't ready at that point. But so sometimes it's not the right time, and that, you know, for whatever reason, but it is right. It does, yeah. And now I'm really enjoying doing that. So
what about other tips for kind of systems and efficiencies. I know you wrote about routine.
So I think when you're working from home, it can be quite difficult to get into routine. Well, everybody knows this now, post-COVID. Mm. But, so I had to develop my own sort of commute.
Right.
Things like that. And some business coaches call it priming the brain, ready for work. And, you know, I do fight with myself sometimes when I get up. I go, so I find that, you know, your brain fills up with your to-do list. I start panicking about things. I get anxious about stuff that really doesn't matter. Part of it is just waking up. But it's also because I'm working by myself. And I do think some of that is mitigated by that initial sort of coffee water cooler chat that you have in an office.
Yeah.
To override that, I do a combination of things, or just choose one of them, which is go for a walk to a cheerful podcast, nothing too serious. It has to be cheerful. And I have tried meditation and just listen to the birds and stuff. And I do that in short bursts, but I find my mind fills too easily with my to-do list and it's just a pain. So the cheerful podcast overrides that, and that really helps. And I also do a thing from Julia Cameron's book, The Artist Way, which is the morning pages, which Tim Ferriss okay. talks about doing as well. So it depends. I don't do both very often. I usually do one or the other, but both seem to help get my brain in the right mode, and then I can just crack on.
So that's your sort of morning routine. And then, I mean, one of the guess the luxuries of working from home is that it doesn't have to be the morning. It can be elsewhere in the day. And what do you find works for you?
I'm sort of a middle of the road person, really. Mornings are more productive. I have a bit of a dip in lunch, post lunch, or around lunch, and then I pick up again late afternoon, sort of 3 o'clock onwards. So yeah, that's you know, since having a 4-year-old, tea time is nicely in that extra productive time. So that's just, you know, had to go for a bit, but I did find that a useful little bit of time beforehand. So I often do things like prep up the slow cooker in the morning or at lunchtime, so I have a bit more of that extra productive time before tea. Whereas people who work with me, they're more evening people or they're more early birds, so that's the nice thing about flexible working. So we tend to just all convene in the middle of the day at some point on Slack.
The overlap bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it does mean that, you know, I have a colleague who works in the evening because it suits her around the small children, which means that her questions come overnight, which I don't look at because I turn all my notifications off. I'm very strict about that. But then I'll respond the next day and then she'll have that for the next thing. But there's a bit in the middle of the day when there's direct conversation going on, which works also. So we just make it work between us. But it's important that it's really important to me. I set, you know, all my colleagues turn their notifications off.
Yeah.
At the times they're not working, because otherwise it's just ping, ping, ping all the time, isn't it? You can't focus on anything, and it leaks into your playtime or your home time.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely feel that I could be better at turning off notifications, because if I get a notification, it takes me out of, you know, my free time, but also it quite often won't get dealt with. I sort of categorize it in my head as done because it's come in at an off time, and if I just left it or never knew about it until I was next working, I'd be able to do it there and then.
Yeah. I've had some really painful weekends when I've looked at, I've accidentally, with quote marks, looked at my email on a Saturday morning, and there's, you know, because clients have more time at the weekend, so they will often email you at the weekend or evenings. And, you know, and then that's ruined my whole weekend because I'm thinking about that problem, whatever it is. And I can't actually do anything about it really until Monday because the engineers are closed or something, you know, the builder, whatever, isn't available. So it's just total pointless angst. And it's taken me a while. I suppose the past couple of years I've been really good at not doing that. And my life is way better. Just the stress, it's so horrible. Yeah, and you know, the problems still get solved in the same amount of time. Nothing changes on that front. It's just my stress is like less than half.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, which means that when you do come to solve it, you're better anyway.
Yeah. But it is a discipline not to check your emails, and part of that, I suppose, part of that has helped with having things to do with my son on Saturday morning, take him swimming and things like that. So, but even before that, I'd be like, no, I'm going to the allotment. I'm going for a run. I'm going out with friends. It's good actually to do things with other people, because then you can't be distracted by your emails, because it's just rude if you're looking at your phone and you're with your friends. So you don't do it.
You have that sort of accountability to being there with them.
Yeah. So I find things like that help. And a business coach I work with also said, like, imagine the things you could be doing if you weren't solving that annoying problem at the wrong time anyway. Like all the, you know, the lovely things. And that's a real motivator too. Yeah, rather than moving away from, it's like moving towards.
Yes. So that's a good example of setting boundaries, sort of boundaries between work and life. Are there any other tips you've got on that?
I'd say also it's about training clients not to expect things at the wrong times. Like if you answer their emails at weekends or in the evenings, they'll go, oh, Claire's around at that time. I will keep doing that. So, you just have to. And actually in our welcome pack, when we say to clients, it says in it, we don't work at weekends and in evenings. Even though I know some of my team do work in evenings, that doesn't mean it's expected. It's, you know, it's up to them to set that. They wouldn't normally do client interaction. It would be literally just getting on with the thing when their kids are asleep, that kind of thing. And that works really well. And people respect that. They want you to have a good life. They don't expect you to be on the demand all the time. And that's never caused me any problems. It's just setting your own boundaries and having the confidence to stick to it as well, which is also, I suppose, with everything really, it's knowing what the benefit is by doing that. This is the massive benefit that I'm going to get. And then that's very motivating.
Yeah. Yes. Positive reinforcement. I think that's good. Nice. There's a chapter in your book, I think titled, is it The Mistakes I've Made? Or
yeah. Loads of mistakes.
is there a good example in there that we can talk about?
I think this is a very common business owner one anyway, I think, which is at the beginning you do have to do everything yourself because you have to. And it's good to do that because you need to know how everything works before you start delegating. Otherwise you won't be able to spot when things aren't working as well as they should and that sort of thing. But there's a line between doing it all and doing way too much. And it's impossible to be good at all of the things. And the less you do, the better, really. But in the early stages, there isn't enough cash for that because you're just setting up and stuff. But so one of my bigger mistakes was when I had my son, I'd previously built the website and maintained it and done everything. And then, of course, when my son came, I was very focused on making sure architectural clients were still happy and my team was still supported. But I neglected the website a bit. So I didn't notice two quite crucial things, which meant that the website got very, very slow and our inquiries just dropped off a cliff. And so then I had to put my staff on reduced hours, some of them, and we discussed it all between us. And so the people who really needed the work kept the work, but other people had other projects, like either study or research or other things that that worked. I mean, I was fortunate also, it was around study deadline time. So actually all a couple of students that I employed really didn't want to be working anyway. Mm-hmm. So, but I felt absolutely dreadful because, you know, I'm responsible for paying them. And, but it was just 2 months, and I rebuilt the website over a period of time, not literally in those 2 months. I went out networking, and because that's more instant, and rewrote offers so that it was more attractive, and got the cash flow moving faster, and yeah, rebuilt the website so it worked better. But I was like, this can't happen again. So now I have a website person. Because I quite enjoy website design and building, and I love writing the stuff and having the flexibility to just be able to go, oh, I want to write a blog, and just plonk it up and then done. And I was worried someone would take that away from me, but actually that's not true. That, you know, it varies on who you work with, I think, but it's very easy to find a web designer who will let you have quite a lot of control still, but will do all of the maintenance and ensure mm-hmm. it stays really good, and add all of their expertise, which of course I didn't have. I'm not a trained website designer. I'm an architect. So that was a big mistake, but you know, in the end it worked out. And mm-hmm. I did develop really brilliant cash flow systems because of that, because I had to.
That's brilliant. Okay, well, I'm conscious of the time. Is there anything you want to say more about work-life balance?
I think with work-life balance, it's never perfect all the time. That's what I've learned. And not to beat yourself up about that. I mean, sometimes you just slip off the wagon a bit and get into some unhealthy practices. The point is, if you've got the tools to bring yourself out of it quickly, then you do it less, far less, mm-hmm. and life is better as a result. But it's always a learning thing. You know, it's never going to be perfect, but I feel like it's a nice place to be at the moment.
Oh, well, that's very pleasing to hear. yeah, well, I know so many people running businesses that are just overworked and underpaid and underappreciated.
Yeah.
So nice to know that it can be done.
Yep, it definitely can be done.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ah, excellent. Thank you, Claire. Really, really nice to hear about the ways that we can just get better at being business people. I'm not an architect, but I have taken so much from that, especially around the boundaries. I am terrible for looking at my phone all the time, and I always see those emails come in, and they're always putting me on edge and stopping me from relaxing, and they've just got to stop, haven't they? Wow. Tomorrow is going to be a new chapter in my life. As always, check out the show notes. There are a few links to Claire's work, Claire's books, and also a couple of the books that I mentioned, The E-Myth and The Artist's Way. I don't know if you could hear. I tried to edit them all out, but my stomach was growling through that. Hopefully I managed to edit them all out. But if you did hear one, apologies. I also nearly edited out a moment when I started to say I should, and I replaced it with could, which is a thing. I don't think I've talked about this. Maybe I have. But it's a thing I try to do to be nice to myself. The idea being that if I say I should have done that, it takes out any of the choice and that there's only one answer and that that's the right answer. But actually, if you say I could have done that, you're opening up all the possibilities and just being a lot friendlier to yourself, accepting that there's many possibilities and many, many ways to do a thing. So I left that in, maybe in the hope that you might do the same and be nicer to yourself, because I'm really needing to be nice to myself at the moment. I had a little rant at the end of one of the last episodes and it made one of the listeners cry. So I'm definitely not going to do that again. Instead, I'm just going to end by saying I hope you enjoyed this episode. Roll straight on to episode 81 and you get more of the wonderful Claire Nash, this time talking about contemporary vernacular design, how British housing can rediscover its soul. Whoa. See you soon.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.